Philosophy 9, January 6th, 1954.
About this in two lectures at some length. The history of the economic as an attempt to increase in peacetime the economy by intensification, not just to have no war, but to do something in peacetime about the economy. Well, that was the topic. And let me speak about this first. It has been made a very interesting mistake, which is as important as the metabolism of allogenos. You remember that this metabolism of allogenos is that again and again. Many of you have clearly seen that Mr. Simon was in the same quandary, that he treated his marriage as something belonging to his him individually, not being owned by his wife as well. That the metabolism of his personal bride into a union where it doesn't belong. You remember the paper on Mr. Simon's strange unemployment, that he didn't tell his wife. Now that's a typical metabolism of allogenos. Some others saw that he lived still in the 19th century and hadn't taken the step into the union era. The metabolism of allogenos is equaled by another logical mistake, gentlemen. Then you treat your marriage as though it was your private affair and not as much your wife's affair as yours. You commit a metabolism as allogenos because you put your one equals one ego in a situation where you have to have the humility to say it isn't mine. The truth between husband and wife is just not under your scrutiny, you see. It is a condition of your being married. Therefore, you cannot prefigure what the reaction is. If you want to shelter your wife against the truth, you see, you break your marriage. Because you have no right, you see, to be stronger than the two together. That's just your metabolism is allogenous. Many men tried, of course. We'll come to this a moment later. But in this moment, let me talk to you about this most frequent abuse of words today in America. The two words are economy and society. The word society is so frequently used that you are never sure whether it's used in the singular, the great society, or whether it's used nationalistically, as in Walter Lippmann's book, The Good Society, just America, or whether it's used in the plural, all the societies in the world. There are societies for the cruelty against animals, and there are societies against the cruelty for animals. But there are societies in the plural. However, when I speak of society, I write it with a capital S, and I stress the singular of this term, society. Now, you have to make up your mind, do you mean America as your society? Do you mean the little society of the small town? Do you mean the society, you see, the alumni society, or the signet society, or the porcelain club? Do you mean any one of these societies? Most of you are not clear at all. And therefore, you always assign the quality of one society, one concept of society, to the other concept of society, which you cannot do without going utterly wrong. And that's the real division between the communists and you, gentlemen. In Russia, at least one thing is clear. Which society they mean? They mean the one spelled with a capital S. There are no societies for the Russian, for the Marxian mind. There's just society. But for you, it's occasionally this and occasionally the other, and that is called, gentlemen, a change of your universe of thought. Universe of thought. That is, the inside of your society has different expanses, different lengths, widths, and heights, so to speak. It is a different area. This is a very interesting expression by a great English logician, Morgan, Augustus Morgan of 1860. He says that most people move constantly in great confusion because they have overlapping various universes of discourse. Universes of discourse is his technical expression. I propose to you that you put these two great fallacies down, because in discussion of all political and all social questions, all religious questions, they are at the bottom of most fallacies and most sterile and disagreeable conversations. Because the speaker doesn't know that he is actually dealing with different universes of discourse. If you speak of societies as a plural, you move within the nation or within the church. But you do not move within society. In philosophy 10, I make much about this singular of society. But we have, of course, dealt in this course with the individual in modern society, haven't we? Now, if you analyze what we have done, gentlemen, we have been leading up to the unity of society, because we have discussed all the possible situations of any man on this globe. War, men at play, men at work, men at war, men in love, men abnormally alone, you see. These are all universal situations. And, as we now shall see in the last months of this course, they are driving us towards a conscious life inside this unity of society. So if this course is called The Individual Within Modern Society, it is saying that society demands from us that amount of consciousness by which we ensure its oneness, its unity. It's a part of the social process that by knowing of its laws, it must become one. And by not knowing that it is one, we prevent it from becoming one. For example, we then stay nationalists. If you do not study war and peace, as we have tried to do, if you only read the Constitution in Political and Government 9, or what, how do you call this department here? Then you simply arm for the next war, which all people in this college do. This is good nationalism here. With all the talk about the League of Nations, now here is nothing taught that is universal. The church is national and doesn't set like nice charities in Japan and China, but that doesn't alter the fact that the church in which you move is a nationalistic church. It's inside America, nothing else. And on it goes. So all the thought on this campus denies the singular of society. It's all many societies. The whole, all the social sciences, therefore, are also pluralistic. There are any number of social sciences. Every day they add another one. Yes, because they get money for it in their research. Very tempting. The more social sciences you have, the more money you can spend. If there's only one social science, there's probably not very much money to be spent, but just decent behavior. And who wouldn't choose money if the alternative is decent behavior? Gentlemen, on this singular of society depends very much. The same is true of the word economic. These boys didn't write on society, but they wrote on economics and war. Now there are, when in the discussion we had here, there are three economies underlying, especially today. There is the planet as a household of raw materials, there's oil, there's coal, there's tin in Bolivia, etc. That's one economy in which you and I as Americans participate from one corner, and the Bolivians are on the other, and the Russians are the third, and everybody on this globe has a little, have something, and some have not. And usually are treated rather badly, like the poor Italians. So, but if we say have not nations and have nations, as it was usually done during this last World War, then you already admit that they have not a share in the economy, which is singular, gentlemen. Would you kindly see this? Which is one economy. Because the universe of discourse then is the planet. It's a planetary economy. And I insist that it is a planetary economy. And you cannot use here the word world economy. That has profound reasons, in which we will deal in 58 for anybody who takes that course. The second thing, there is a second economy. There is an economy of the two possible belligerents, A and B, Russian economy and my economy. That would omit Paraguay probably and Fiji Islands, because they are not directly involved in the economy of the two. But this is then the belligerent economy. And then there is my economy, the American economy. Now, most of the gentlemen who have written this paper have never really decided of which economy they are talking. They have left it in the same dark as the tech school people do, who also are very careful never to say whether they are really national economists or universal economists. Because if they would say this, then they would have to include war into their thinking. But in this nice way, you see, I opened a book yesterday again, and it said the Americans, Mr. Walter, no, it was Walter Lippmann's editorial, his column. And he said the poor American people, they have gone through such an agony for the last 20 years. It all began with the depression of 29, and on it goes. There you have a wonderful nationalistic outlook. The depression starts the whole thing, not the First World War. You see, in which all the nations were participants, the whole world. It's called the World War for this reason, you see. But in 1929, the memory of America is good enough to remember. Everything before was just accidental. Poor Woodrow Wilson, he's forgotten. As though the word, the Depression of 29 is not just simply the penalty paid for the incredible behavior of this country after World War I. Nothing else. The attempt to forget the First World War. So, but this is, you see, how the economists have created this source form around their science by never telling us whether they mean the American economy or the belligerent economy of the two rivals. In every case, England, America, Germany, America, you see, China, America, whatever it is, Japan, America, you think, you perhaps remember there was a scrap iron issue between Japan and us. We forbade finally the trading of selling of scrap iron to Japan, but we didn't forbid the trading of scrap iron to the Belgian Congo. That is, we had a belligerence economy, haven't we? And we have it now when the senators do not understand that you have to be glad that there is trade with China, and you cannot poo-poo it. They are waking up to this at this moment. That it is a great privilege for us and a great benefit for our politics if we have trade relations with China, and not the opposite. Since they cannot include war and peace at the same time in their thinking, they have to say either or, and thereby destroy this country. If a great nation as this cannot see, at the same time have peace and war, it doesn't understand how we live today. We live in this twilight where peace and war are both present. You see. But you would like children to have like a wife. Virtue and vice. That's why we push the poor Chinese communists into the Russian fold, because we won't recognize them as even existing. So what can they do? They love Moscow. Against their will. Because nobody wants to think in terms of peace and war. Gentlemen, the nation, like the communists themselves, the Bolsheviks, who have learned that war and peace are only relatively different, you see, but not totally. That nation that learns this first will have the political initiative. And we have lost it. We have no initiative. Absolutely none for the last 5 years in politics. That's a mistake if Mr. Dennis insists that he has it. By saying so, he doesn't get it. He cannot have the initiative because the people in this country want to have either peace or war. You won't have it for the next 100 years, gentlemen. You have to live too gaily in peace only. And we must be very glad if we have peace and war, and not just war only. This is very serious, you see, for your thinking. If the economy is that which God has given to this earth as a whole, the Lord's is the earth and not yours. Who are you? Tenants, trustees. Who owns America? Do you think you own it? It's ridiculous. If you are underpopulated here, if nobody comes in, and if you only live 160 or 170 million people, do you think the rest of the world will say this is America? Therefore, you mustn't touch it. The next thing will be that they come on boats and ships and airplanes and settle. You think you can hold an empty space like Canada with 8 million people for a long time? Or Australia, for that matter. It's all fantastic. You can only, when you start from the assumption that the Australians, own Australia, where they were sent there because they were, otherwise they would have been sent to prison. That's why they are there. You think they own Australia, which is utterly ridiculous. They didn't discover it, you see. And they were sent there, shipped there. And then you see, this is Australia. And that's how you think, this is America. Gentlemen, that's too cheap. You have to earn America by opening it wide enough and populating it sufficiently so that it can be held in comparison to other continents with the same density and with the same sacrifice and with the same seriousness and at the same price. There's no having anything in this world. Doesn't exist. This you would immediately see if you had the knew what your universe of discourse is. Which economy do you mean? Do you mean the economy of the empty spaces and the dense spaces? If you think in economic terms really on this globe, you would know that this market-seeking society of America depends on world markets. Do you think the Canadians can produce 1 billion bushels of wheat every year without integrating themselves into the rest of the world to which they have to sell this wheat? This is standard impossible. Canada is not a sovereign country in economic respect. It may be militarily or politically, but obviously this wheat has to go somewhere, and these people must remain able to pay for this wheat. You know this too. So what's the use of calling Canadian wheat Canadian wheat? It's wheat that happens to grow within the political confines of Canada, but economically speaking, it's wheat that has to be eaten, which is very different because the mouths that can eat the wheat are not living in Canada under no circumstances because, as you know, the Canada farmer lives in Winnipeg in the winter and has his machines running out there in the country. He's not even a farmer who lives on his land, you see. He's an absentee farmer. So who owns this? Well, as long as you think in the terms of a national economy, you have very easy going. It's all identical. Canada, economy, therefore you say Canadian economy. I advise you to think twice before you say this, gentlemen. There is no American economy. The attempt of Mr. Eisenhower to make good weather and to say, I'm responsible for prosperity, that's witchcraft. That's nonsense. No political leader can make for good crops. That Pharaoh of Egypt did by cheating, by sorcery. But that's not the truth. The economy is not a business for government. It has never been. It cannot. It's the question of you and my work and our peaceful relation to the rest of the world. And these peaceful relations mean that the economy everywhere is either smaller than America or bigger than America. You can have a valley economy, you see, and you can have a city economy, and you can have a state economy, but why it should coincide with the frontiers of America, you see? That it only will with regard to warships and airplanes and those things which the government orders, and which can only be used, you see, by the armed forces of the United States. In this respect, our economy is a national economy indeed, you see.
Sir, you said it is not a business of government, that is, economy is not a business. Do you feel that the government should keep out of the economy, let it run itself, and
No, sir. If we see today that economy is prevalent, and with the shakiness of you and me with regard to unemployment, we obviously need social and economic order. This all points beyond the existing political boundaries. For example, you have to integrate with Africa or India or England or France or Germany in some form, simply because our economy, you see, cannot coincide with the constitutional boundaries of the 48 states. It cannot. You see, my reasoning is that the economy must look for its own boundaries. During the last 30 years, as you know, we have something called fascism, which is an attempt to make economy coincide with the boundaries of the state, you see, with all the dire aspects of this confusion between politics and economics. Can you see this? And we are at this moment You see, hard put, the security of the country demands that large orders are given to the economy by the national leadership. And in so far, we get a national economy, you understand? But in as far, you see, there are many reasons why we shouldn't get more than one-third, let me say, of a national economy. Because the rest, you see, we must be able to sell to other people and to receive from other people. Take all the inventions, for example. We still have a vital interest that there's a free flow of inventions. We have a vital interest that our capital is allowed to invest in Canal. We are not so much, as you know, interested at this moment in exports of commodities, but we are terribly interested in the flow of capital to other countries. Now, that's the same thing as commodities, only from the money side, you see. If you can export money, and other people can import their goods to this country, you no longer have a national economy. You understand this? And to show you, did I tell you the story of Mr. André Philippe and the neutrality legislation in this country? Did I? Well, I think this is to the point. Let me say, put it very simply. Mr. André Philippe was Minister of Finance in the French government before the Second World War. And leftist, belonged to, the, I think, to the socialist group, but moderate. And we had the legislation of Mr. Senator Bora of inglorious memory, in which he, inglorious, but of course I think he, the assumption being that he wasn't doing this without ulterior motives. This neutrality legislation said that in peacetime we could trade with everybody, but in wartime we were not allowed to sell to the belligerents anything. So Monsieur André Philippe came in great confusion to this country, and he visited Dartmouth and he visited me, and he said, now what shall we do? France must rely for airplanes especially, but for other things of war material on America in wartime. And we would buy constantly in peacetime in these lines, because we wouldn't build up our own factories. Now you say, when the war breaks out, we won't sell you one thing. That was the ingenious idea of Mr. Bora. You see, like the good school teacher, the bad boy has to be punished. These people quarrel, and we are so good, you see, we don't drink alcohol, and therefore we won't commit crimes. That's what the idea here was. And all these old ladies applauded and castrated this country, because Mr. Philippe said, this is castration. When a friend is in need, you say, I won't give you anything. But when we don't need it, you are willing to trade with us. This means, in so many words, that France has, against her will, that was in 1936, to build up now immediately an aircraft industry. Because in the time of need, we must have these factories running. Therefore, you Americans, destroy the division of labor between France and America, which is just in the process of developing. We have no mass production as you can afford. Therefore, it's very expensive and very uneconomical to us, you see. It's waste, but you do it for all your prohibitionist ideas about life, you see. The American is such an ethicist that he thinks that he can stop living, you see. And when a war breaks out, he just says, I don't live anymore. I have an ostrich head, you see, and put it in the sand. When the war is over, I come out again and look around and hope that everything is to the best, for the best. Well, this is called a country, gentlemen. It is nothing but insanity. I mean, the people in Concord wouldn't do any worse. It's schizophrenic, you see. To split the existence of this mighty nation into two halves. In wartime, I'm somebody different from what I am in peacetime. And this is the true story of a minister of France, André Philippe, in 1936, facing the, you see, the old spinster attitude of America, which is constantly trying to get rid of its genitals. Yes, because the genitals are this power in us which admits that life has to be regenerated every moment and that you can't plan it as a blueprint. That you have to love people and to hate them. But since you have always to be kind and keep smiling and have a mind to everything, an open mind even, you see, so there's no decision in anything. There's no war and no peace. There's this terrible lukewarm situation in between. This is very serious because, gentlemen, this is daily your temptation. You have learned it in your little squirrels. You have been exposed 10 years too long to women's teachers. And you can't shake this off. And now what do? You drink in your fraternity of all kind of ridiculous protests against this women in front. But you are not men. That is, you are not naive and simply virile. Because otherwise you would laugh all these ideas which have dominated in this country for the last 40 years. You would laugh them out of court. This pacifism and all this nonsense. That this is deeply in it. You have a guilty complex when you say war is necessary. You look around and say, I hope she doesn't hear it. You all have the look for the kindness of the people who have sheltered you and spoiled you and ruined you. You're so nice, gentlemen, that you can't live anymore. You are nice, I assure you. But there is a limit to not being nice. This is, I think, the greatest nation in the world saying to a minister of a foreign country, in peacetime we will furnish you with the necessities, but not in wartime, because then you are wicked. Is this a behavior to friends? We have let down every friend in need. Here, Syngman Rhee, when the prisoners ran away and everybody should have applauded him, you remember. Here in this town, I have had to see you young people saying, oh, my give a war, that's terrible. In every church they pray for 2,000 years for the prisoners as the poorest of the poor. But when here 27,000 people were allowed to go free, then everybody here was trembling in his shoes and said, that's against our bargaining, our dollars and cents policy. Or cross the counter with these criminals, these communists, we have traded the skin of these 28,000 prisoners.
Do you think that Syngman Rhee let these men go free because of religious belief?
No, because they were Koreans. This man has fought since 1904 for the freedom of Korea, my dear man. We sold Korea. He protested in 1904. We sold Korea in 1919. He protested. The Japanese took it over, you see. And he protested and was tortured for years every day. Do you think such a man makes a difference whether there's a 38th degree of latitude? That's another such schoolboy arrangement, to cut a living body of a country because you could afford this here on the 54th degree of latitude with nobody living there. You can cut a continent, which is pure space, into 54 degree latitude, but can you divide the Bronx in this manner? That's what we have done to Korea. We did it. We had this wonderful idea of the 38th degree. You see, this is the thing. It's the famous, you know the story of King Solomon, two women coming for him and quarreling and saying, and she's saying, divide the child. And the real mother of the child said, no, don't do it. Then the wrong mother may have it, because I don't want to see this child killed. Now, what have we done? We were not King Solomon, you see. But we were the opposite king who really meant to have the child divided and thought that was an answer. And a nation is a living thing. Wouldn't you feel like this? If the one half of the United States would be given to somebody else, that it was like cutting into the living flesh of a unit? Can you imagine this? Is Korea any worse than the United States? They had deserved well, they hadn't committed any crime, they were guilty of anything. The Japanese had mistreated them, the Russians had mistreated them, the Chinese, and we come and do worse. We say the country has to be divided by the 38th degree of latitude. So Mr. Syngman Rhee, with regard to these 27,000 people, said, I do not recognize the division, you see. They are my people. You see, I can't have prisoners of war who are Koreans. They're my brothers. I don't care what they think.
See,
and he paid, I mean, it paid. They all liked him. They liked the idea that they were treated as compatriots. And why shouldn't they? Who is from Western Mississippi in this room? Only one? Two? Well, how would you like the idea that these people would say, you see, we can't help you in you because you are prisoners from the other side of the river? Impossible idea. Now we come to this is then my answer. The universe of discourse of economy and society, gentlemen, today is mixed up in your mind. It's partly American, partly it's just the Boston mixture, or it's Long Island plus New York for butter and milk and eggs and New Jersey perhaps. And partly it is the economy always of your rival, the belligerents, of the two belligerents, and partly it's the real economy of the whole planet. It's a planetary economy. And I, as I told you, in 58, you talk more about this, I cannot explain why the term should be planetary. Or perhaps I should say this. You see, world trade, world market, is always only looked upon, here's America, and this is a world trade going in all directions, going China Clipper and going to Hong Kong and going to India and going to Africa. This would be the idea of a world that could still be faced, looked at from America, egocentric, you see. World, just the world around us. But a planet makes it quite sure that the viewpoint is taken from the whole of the planet. And we are inside this planet at some eccentric spot. Therefore, the word planetary is the only sane word if you want to know of which economy you're actually talking. Are you talking about the very simple question, how much tin does there exist in the world, or how much atomic energy? Then you're beginning to talk planetary. Mr. President Eisenhower did talk planetary economy for the first time when he proposed this institute, you see, for atomic civilian energy. That's planetary. Because it is not looked upon from one national economy. Can you see the difference? So throw out world economy. There is no world economy. There's just world war. But planetary is possible because that begins with the great respect that there's only a limited supply of goods on the whole planet. It doesn't help you to grab all 9/10 of the riches of the world. As you know, we have 48% of the products of every year in this country for 7% of the people of the earth. Now, how long do you think we can afford this? How long do you think the rest of the peoples will tolerate this distribution? The second thing, gentlemen, is this business of Mr. Simon as a married man, as a person in business, as a non-unionized man, and I have to say only a few things, but they are quite important. Gentlemen, the equation one is one can never be better illustrated than by this case of a man who wants to stick to a job and commits suicide when he can't find a job. Because it does show you, gentlemen, that the soul has to do with the invisible, with the things that are not expressed either in dollars and cents or in a locality. For the soul of man, you are a free man, it doesn't matter that you have to pack up and leave New York. It didn't matter to my soul that I had to leave Germany and come to this country. It mattered very much to my social role in society, you see. It mattered very much to my mind, because I had to think new things, you see. And it mattered very much to my environment, to my natural fight for existence, to my bodily existence. It didn't matter at all to my soul, quite the contrary. Only because I left this other space, you see, could I save my soul. Now, but the condition of Mr. Simon saving his soul is that he doesn't confuse any physical part of his existence, in this case his wherewithal, his role as a breadwinner, you see, with his soul, which you do all the time. Gentlemen, you have not learned to use the term soul right. In your paper it was quite clear to me that you were groping for this. But the one condition, please take it, put it down, attached to the use of the word soul is that you ascribe to the soul the power to survive change of environment, change of body, and change of mind, and change of role. And this he didn't, you remember. He thought that his visible identity of being a white-collar man, an employee in a decent firm, you see, was identical with his soul. Most of you do this. It is very difficult to understand that a dishonored person can have all the more soul because society doesn't reclaim him and doesn't recognize him. Your integrity as a soul can only be tested if you can survive environmental change, mental change. Well, some of you have expressed this very nicely in your paper, but none of you has seen clearly that Mr. Simon was challenged to find his soul, to develop his soul, at the penalty of losing his job. That he had the occasion of turning this experience into an asset simply by discovering that he was not to be identified with any external position in society. You see, this is the challenge. The soul always comes to our rescue with a new pride and say, if I am humiliated, if I am humbled by my peers, by my environment, by the people who thought they were, I was a member of their group, you see, then I discover my real powers. You see, the soul thrives on the invisible, which is nothing mystical, but it is the power. Goethe has called it, the German poet has said, we have to place ourselves in times into non-existence in order to come into existence. And takes this down because it is your best weapon against this modern existentialism. All these existentialists in France and Germany, and here in the US, as far as the imitators and apes of this go in this country, these existentialists always say that we exist. But gentlemen, the greatness of man only is found when he says it is better not to exist than to exist in this manner. The non-existence is the experience of the soul. Then the soul is still in being when the man doesn't seem to exist. Because exist is materially visible in the senses. Every one of you has to be able to live through a cocoon stage in which, in the eyes of the world, he is somebody else. He isn't yet the one who one day will shake the foundations of the universe by his actions. In this moment, he seems to be non-existent. He's out in pasture. And this non-existent, gentlemen, is the state of the soul. The withdrawal of Mr. Simon, therefore, is nothing unhealthy. And some of your lamentations about the poor man and the poor state of society, therefore, I think is not quite in order, because any one of us, at times at least, has to be tested in this manner. The second thing is I won't go into this case too much, but if you have these three laws, 1 = 3, 1 = 2, 1 = 1, and 1 = infinity. I do think that I give you the example of Simon, of the longshoreman, and of the Dakota farmer. Now, except one, everyone missed the bus about the Dakota farmer. You did not see, gentlemen, that in Dakota on a farm, the couple is in business, not the men. And that he didn't have to solve the problem whether he had to tell his wife or not. She knew. That is, when you are on a farm, the question isn't that you are in business at all. The family's in business. And from the very first moment, the drought or whatever it is, the sunburn, that's all on the women and on the children just as heavily pressing as on the men. There is no office hour, and there's no commuting. And none of you has seen that, therefore, the Dakota farmer just hasn't to solve this problem, whether I tell my wife or not, you see. It is there. They are in business together. Can you see this? Isn't this clear? Now, therefore, we have really three different human beings. The starting point for the Dakota farmer, which makes him stronger and healthier, is that his wife knows as much about it as he himself. That is a great relief, you see. The union worker, theoretically, could treat his Irish girl as such an utility idiot that he won't tell her, but he has his union. So he has this here. He has this dream of solidarity, and it works. Cost some lives on the piers of New York, but Murder Incorporated, still union. I've never understood how these Mr. Bradley and Mr. Ryan get away without ever mentioning the killing that have gone on, even as you know, during over the last month on the piers. This is frightful to me. But it means idolatry to the one equals infinity, to the union principle. You can see this. I mean, everything goes, if we are in the union, then we can murder. Now, Mr. Simon has another idea, the bourgeois ideal of one equals one. But it is a business idea, an idea of the independent man. And you have here a typical metaphysis and analogenos, the union man who doesn't tell his wife, and Mr. Simon who doesn't tell his wife, may do it with different consequences. The union man may survive, although he doesn't tell it at home, you see. And Mr. Simon cannot survive because he's all by himself, and when he doesn't tell his wife, he doesn't open up any moral reserves, you see. But both, and this is important, gentlemen, socialism or communism on the one hand side and capitalism or individualism are both distortions of true humanity, just equally bad when they lead to an encroachment on the other forms, here on marriage. If Mr. Simon doesn't tell his wife and perishes, and if the longshoreman doesn't tell his wife that he has murdered somebody in the interest of the union, you see, they are equally, you see, perverted, equal perverts. The metaphysis of allogenesis is happening, that is, they try to live all the four corners of their lives out of one source, and they don't give the one equals two its due. The Dakota farmer, you see, may be only care for his own land. Farmers, as you know, are very greedy. Workers are not greedy individually. They are very generous. And city people. But farmers are not, as a rule. But this, they live out of this. And they, of course, can then be sinful by carrying the healthy egotism of the family, only caring for your own kin, you see, next of kin, into the other fields where they have no access to spiritual orders, or very hardly, very often not. It's much more difficult for a farmer to understand unions and here, these movements, these spiritual movements, and it's very more difficult for him to understand the risk a professional man has to take. His independence of judgment is setting himself off against the family, you see, his rebellion about the traditions of the family, which any independent thinker must go through with. You see that every one of them then commits easily a metaphysis allogenos by exaggerating the environmental situation of his physical existence, of his business activities, and applying this to the three other parts. Is this clear? My question, therefore, about longshoremen and Dakota farmer with regard to Mr. Simon wasn't quite arbitrary. It rounds out the picture that the incompleteness of our behavior, which tries to cover something that must remain foreign to my business life, you see, to cover this with the principles I've learned in business, that this goes on in every segment of our society. You have made very much fodder about the fact that Mr. Simon is obsolete. He is in retrograde. Certainly, he is diminishing in numbers. But so is the farmer. But I wish you to understand that all these forms are purely secular forms of passing importance. The worker, the businessman, and the farmer. No one can save his soul by just being a worker, by just being a farmer, by just being a businessman. Comes an emergency, you see, he must have another power. And the soul is not identical with Mr. Simon's 1 = 1 in business. The liberal idea is that at work I'm 1 in 1. But the idea of my pamphlet, The Multiformity of Man, is that man is only in his course of his life 1, when he can join together the various phases of his life into oneness, you see. That's something quite different. Mr. Simon wants to have a visible identity. Here, 1 = 1 in his office. He wants to own this identity, so to speak, you see. This we cannot. And therefore, this is the gist of it, gentlemen. Any one of these groups, carries some eternal truth about you and me into the field of their purely social business activity. The liberal says, I have learned in church that I am an immortal soul. Therefore, I'm for free enterprise. Because the free enterprise is the appropriate symbol of the freedom of my soul. Do you understand? He identifies a reflection of this real quality of you and me, you see, in the course of our lives, from child to death, with any special situation on which you can put, you see, your finger and say, this is it. The same is true of the worker. It is very good to strive for the progress of humanity, to belong to the one Catholic Church of the human race. But if you want to have an inner union, you see, and make this actual unit sovereign, you get with the Longshoremen Murder Incorporated. And this is a very interesting case, but don't be too supercilious. You get all the sects, any sectarian movement, you see, identifies a partial solution of infinity with a total solution of infinity. That's why you shouldn't be sectarians, gentlemen. Don't be sectarians. A sect is always confusing the infinity into which we are moving, that all men in a certain extent belong to each other, with some relative realization like a union. A union is a secular sect. If you see, gentlemen, that the farmer also, as you know, is now dying off because the farm wives in Dakota won't stand for it. Farming is dying in this country not because it's uneconomical, but because there are no wives who want to marry these farmers. They want to go to the movies, but it isn't just the movies, it is they don't want to put up with this kind of life in which they have just been an other draft animal on the farm. And that's even more true in Europe and in Russia as it is here. The collective farm idea in Russia has this appeal, not to the men, but to the women. Because they were just beasts of burden, you see. And you can hardly here understand it, because here in this country, you know, women have not worked in the fields. Now, all over Europe and all over Russia, the women do work in the fields. And that's why the agrarian, you see, question is there very clear. The one equals two economy of farming, you see, is breaking down today before our eyes. We are partially resistant because most of the ladies on our farms already just cultivate their kittens. I once came here to a neighboring farmer, and there was a man hardworking, and there was his wife, and she was just buying on July 1st apples from a city truck that had driven up. So she was no longer farming. They had an apple orchard, but that was no longer sprayed, and they didn't harvest any apples. They bought the apples from New York. And then she said, well, you see, it's rather boring. You have absolutely nothing to do. I was. Why, she had four children. And she had this big place of 200 acres. She had nothing to do. The man was allowed to do the work. And but she said, you have one great concern, you see. The kittens, you know, you don't know what it means to me to have to drown any one of these kittens. And I always place them. But it takes me days and weeks before I find another person to take the litter off my hands. Now that's, you see, no Messalina, no Roman empress could have wasted their life more fruitfully. So these wives, of course, land their men in the morass, because one farmer, no farmer. You have to tie up with somebody else. I mean, you fall sick, then the woman gets a permanent. Now, what I have tried to say, gentlemen, is that any woman expression of one of these ways of life, be it business, be it professorship, be it a college education, you're studying here and playing around, play, war, economics, they all obviously, in the family itself, can go wrong. And the last part of this class, these meetings, gentlemen, we have five more, I think, to come. When do we end? 21st? What's the last day of classes? 28th? You just barely will see what means do exist to correct a disequilibrium of the forces we have so far analyzed. In play, we can get stuck. In war, we can get stuck. In economics, as the case shows you, we can get stuck. And I have to show you now in the family, of course, we can, the family cannot, may not function and may break down. In the 19th century, we had spinsters, too many, as you know, in New England, who couldn't marry. And just think of, the great poetess in Amherst.
Emily Dickinson,
yes. And in this century, I don't know what we get. We'll probably get divorced. Something similar. An impotency of founding families. It seems to be more this way today that the women, when they get in their interesting age, find and run away from the home and leave the husband. There has to be a divorce, but they just get up other interests and don't take the husband with them into these interests. In any some form, there is a great desertion from the inner life of such a family. So economics contribute to this. It isn't today, however, that it is that the girl has to be terribly afraid not to marry so much. It's a more richer or more complicated disease of the family. So let me propose that we shall watch the great attempts of over the last thousands of years to find for every one of us a constant power, a constant reintegration, that whenever we go wrong in any one of these directions, war, economics, family, and luxury, play, dissipation, That's all play, I mean, the non-real. Which power do we have to put us right again? To become the man who can enter all these forms and withdraw from them as a free agent instead of committing suicide, like Mr. Simon. And that's why this case, which I, as you know, just found in the paper the day before, on December 1st, leads up to the question that man is that one animal that can commit suicide and does commit suicide. There is no animal in the world, it seems, that has this amount of freedom that a man, because he has missed his task of forming the group to which he belongs, you see, commits suicide. Maybe a group within himself, I mean, the one equals one, but men commit suicide means that he says, I cannot form those attachments which would make life worth living. This should bear out my contention, gentlemen, that men's attachments rule his life and not men's detachments. Remember, that was, we had quite a long story about detachment and attachment. Suicide is the failure to attach significance to our attachments, to give significance to them. It is the judgment that either the attachments which we have built up are worthless, miscarried, or we won't even enter them. If you commit suicide at 19, then you say it isn't worth it. I'm so detached that whatever attachment could tempt me isn't worth the effort. Or you can blow out your brain at 45 and you say it has not paid. I made wrong attachments and say I'm disappointed. So you can be despondent and desperate before the attachment by your philosophies gained in a liberal arts major in college. Or you can do it afterwards at 45. These are the two corners. In Europe, the corner for suicide is 20. In this country, the corner for suicide is 45. The Europeans have introduced vaccination in this spiritual field, just as you are vaccinated, I hope, against smallpox. That is, the risk of a student committing suicide has been infinitely higher in Europe. The critical mind has wetted himself, you see, against any possible attachment as worthless. The criticism has been so, the analysis has been so steel-like, and has carved up all the seeds of the topsoil in which such attachments might grow. And so the number of suicides in my own class was one third of my classmates committed suicide within the first 6 years after we left school. That's quite terrible. But it was a very good school. And our teachers used to say, that is where you always talk of the survival of the fittest, but you do not know what this means. That means real testing, and not what you call testing business or so. That means the testing of the soul. And these are weaklings who cannot go through the necessary detachment and build up really creative new attachments. This is terrible. But there is no boy I know of, no man at my age in Europe who has not been tempted to commit suicide, hasn't bought a pistol to do it. It's quite something. Therefore, very few people commit suicide in later years. That's all over with when they have taken their degrees, and they are men. They have once tried to take their lives. If they are any healthy, they have learned that you cannot do it. That the detachment is just one phase of becoming better and more attached afterwards. But gentlemen, don't escape from suicide. I mean, I have been a little scared by most of you saying that this couldn't happen to you. The more you postpone this serious contemplation of suicide, the more it will hit you, unprepared and all of a sudden. Sweat it out. It doesn't mean that you should be really tempted by it, but it has some form, it has to enter your life. Or you can't become men. Because, gentlemen, if you do not figure out suicide, you can't have civil courage. Any man who has thought of suicide is no longer afraid of other forms of death. It's a kind of immunity. When you cannot inflict death to you, you know exactly when to stand up and fight for your life from the outside. It's strange, but you gain great courage, great independence. It's like cutting the umbilical cord with the social prejudices of your environment. The victory over your suicidal tendency, you see, is the point in which you emerge into independence and freedom from. Because if your own judgment cannot reach you, this wish, this suicidal wish, you see, and you are more than any one mood inside of yourself, even the blackest mood of suicide, you are much more fey than against any other people's innuendos or hypnotism. That's a very strange connection. You know, all psychoanalysis, Mr. Freud, etc., is full of the declaration that we are self-destructive, that there is a deep tendency in men towards death. You must have heard of these discussions. Well, unfortunately, these people are two great cowards. They wouldn't, otherwise they would simply say that men's great freedom to form new attachments leads them to an intermediary stage in which, because the old attachments are no longer any obligation to him, are no longer binding, he feels tempted, you see, to remain free of all attachments. That is the temptation of suicide. Can you see this? So would you please take down this rhythm? Attachment, detachment, new attachment. Any wrong philosophy at the moment of detachment will provoke suicidal tendencies. But these suicidal tendencies are not to be taken so seriously as the Freudians do, the psychoanalysts. They are the condition of creation. Because you can not get out of attachments, your own family or this college, and you cannot say, no, I won't go to these silly reunions, I wish to found a new college or a better school or go to abroad, or I don't care for these alumni. You can't have any such illusions of grandeur that you are free without having the power to turn them into any direction, suicide being one of them, you see. The revolutionary in Russia says, I destroy society. But if you read The Brother and Karamazov by Dostoevsky, you also read that the same group also can turn against themselves and say, we, you see, will cease to live. It's absolutely ambivalent. And I'm afraid, gentlemen, that the girls in this country will make the race because they do play with us. No, it's terrible, but true. You might spare them this if you would be a little more serious. Somebody has to go to the depths, the abyss of detachment, and that will always mean a hatred of any attachment for a moment, you see. You will be tempted to say, well, since I can look through that my family is no longer meaningful for me, I can't live with these folks, you see, I have to do something else in the world, which is perfectly normal. But obviously he can project this into a general statement and say, therefore no attachment is worth the candle. You understand? This, you cannot stop a car that's withdrawing from one direction, going backward out of the attachments of your family, your country, as Abraham did when he left Haran and as Babylonia and went out into Palestine. The Bible says very simply, he left his kin and kindred, you see, and his home country. Now, anybody who comes to this country does the same. Anybody who has this power can, of course, just stay in this direction too long and say, build on this, you see, a whole ideology. So, detachment, gentlemen, must lead to suicide unless it is understood as an intermediary phase. if you base on the experience of your need for emancipation, for freedom, for independence, for your own decisions. If you base on this a philosophy which is meant to cover your whole existence, the logical outcome is that the universe is just not offering you enough, you see, satisfaction. If, however, you understand that this freedom is given you in between attachments, that all the means given to you to get free, you see, are only means so that the attachment which then comes is genuine, pure, new, powerful, you will see that the workings of your mind have only this limited meaning, that they are within the universe and not, you can't see the universe. You are not outside. You can't criticize the world. We cannot judge the universe. This so-called detachment is always only detachment of certain attachments. Yes? Of certain attachments. It is never, no one can say that he can detach himself from attachment. He can only attach himself from this peculiar form of attachment in which he finds himself. This is therefore the reason why we have to think right, gentlemen. And certainly in this country very few people do think right. Most people think, let independence with us be. And they shout all the time, the British. Oh, they want to enslave us, you see. And something like that. I mean, you find here still these types of who constantly shouting independent. In England, with the British, it is in politics, but it is with everything else. Authority of the parent, authority of the teacher. Let us be objective. Gentlemen, pure objectivity leads to suicide. And it leads, therefore, when the people individually are such cowards that they won't commit suicide, then they construct hydrogen bombs by which the whole universe commits suicide. It's exactly just a projection of your and my objectivity. Because that's what we can do. Men can destroy by pure objectivity, by pure detachment. I mean, this is so terrible in this country. Everybody's so nice and sweet, but we are, after all, the only nation that has thrown the atomic bomb. No other nation has. And Mr. Lawrence thinks that this country is a nation of slayers. Because nobody individually wants to do anybody any harm. Oh, no. Nothing. You're so sweet and so kind, you see. But then you go down to the basement of Baker Library and look how we appear to the Mexicans. It's very strange, gentlemen, that every nation, we all, I too, I know this, we appear to others always in the opposite manner as we appear to ourselves. Therefore, the only way out is to include. But one day you will have to be an uncle yourself. Just can't be it. Uncle you can become without any great effort. So, gentlemen, suicide is the challenge of these four founders of the religious regeneration of mankind. Because Buddha, Lao Tzu, Abraham, and Jesus, they have, in a strange manner, put something in the place of suicide. You can say that the definition of a world religion is a medicine against suicide. It can be total suicide of a nation throwing the atomic bomb. And if you hope that the American people will not commit suicide by throwing the atomic bomb and starting an atomic war, then you mean exactly the same, that some religion in your heart may keep us from using our own capacities, our own... We can show them, can we? But we may not. The religion, gentlemen, tries to identify the can and the may. Very simple formula. Detached people can everything. Attached people may not do certain things. Attachment is the rule of the may, M-A-Y. And Detachment, natural science, objectivity is the lesson of what we can do. We can throw all the bombs at once, you see, or we cannot throw them, you see. All your objectivity only tells you what you can do. All your attachments teach you what you must do, what you may do. Now, there's absolute confusion in this country, you see. Individually, you have school teachers, she teachers. Teacher is she in this country, imagine. In no other country in the world does anybody who hears the word teacher connect with it the idea that this is she. It's impossible. He, a teacher. But in this country, it's she. Therefore, you are all sweet. Light and sweetness. But as a whole, this is an imperialistic, exploiting, slaying, very brutal group. And you don't like to hear that. That's how we appear in the world at large. But everyone says, but I'm not, and he isn't. The may and can words, gentlemen, they have to be reconciled with each other in these last lectures. What we have described is the world of the attachments. The family, the war, the economy, the play, they all contain rules of the game. And anything that is may can contain. We may play in a game only so far, you see. Nothing must become serious. You can't kill the other athlete, you see, from vengeance in a game. The mays are all clear in all the things we have dealt with, gentlemen. But next time I shall start with the disintegration of the family once more, and then we will see that man who can found all these attachments can destroy them. He can. But me? Thank you.